Iran's president tries to reassure his citizens possible sanctions won't bite. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Anu Anand. Good morning. All eyes on the White House as President Trump reveals today if he's pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. Despite lobbying from allies, many expect the president will not stay in the deal, at least not in its current form. It lifts economic sanctions in return for a freeze on Tehran's nuclear program. Iran's president Hassan Rouhani met with oil managers in Tehran this morning and said he wants constructive relations with the world. The BBC's Amir Paivar covers business for the Persian Language Service.
The Iranian president very well remembers at the peak of sanctions only 5-6 years ago, the Iranian economy was shrinking by 7%. The inflation was at 40%. The Iranian currency was falling by the hour, and the economy was basically on the brink of collapse. So the big question whether it will be just the U.S. leaving the deal with the Europeans continuing committing to the terms of the deal, or whether that would mean basically the collapse of the deal.
Now, this is all very complicated, but give us a sense of what sanctions might be on the table.
The U.S. president may say that the U.S. will leave the deal and also snap back its so-called secondary sanctions. These are sanctions on European or Asian firms that work in Iran or buy Iranian crude oil. Or in a less likely scenario, he may say that he is leaving the deal, but without snapping those sanctions back because the Europeans have resisted.
What's the mood in Tehran amongst ordinary people? Are people worried about what might be coming?
They are very nervous, naturally. A good indication of it is looking at Iran's foreign exchange market. In the last, actually, day or two, the trading has been frozen altogether because there is no price, there is no rate, there is no certainty. And that in and of itself has had a knock-on impact on the economy. So that's the sense that people are very, very nervous and worried about the future.
Amir Paivar, let's do the numbers. U.S. crude prices, which traded above $70 a barrel for the first time since 2014 yesterday, have dropped below that line as traders mull what Trump's decision will mean. Meanwhile, Chinese imports and exports rose more than expected last month, according to data out today. The country's trade surplus with the U.S. jumped by nearly $7 billion in April. In Somalia, more than 8 million trees were cut down in 6 years for charcoal. The UN banned its export in 2012 after finding the trade was funding the Al-Shabaab militia. So what do officials ending a two-day meeting on the issue hope to achieve? Peter de Klerk is the UN Deputy Special Representative in Mogadishu.
Somali charcoal is very popular in the Gulf countries. It's appreciated because of its fragrance and because it burns very easily. So people have been demanding and asking this for a very long time. The amount of charcoal being transported is enormous, exporting about 100,000 metric tons of charcoal every year. And that translates into $120 million, which is equivalent in this very poor country to 40% of the national budget.
And a lot of that money is going into the pockets of the Al-Shabaab militia. Do we know how much they're earning?
We know that on charcoal alone, they're making at least $10 million a year. But this is just one source of income. They have other sources of income. Obviously, they are illegally taxing the population in areas that are not under government control.
And that, of course, allows them, for example, to buy weapons. And that just fuels the instability in Somalia. If the ban isn't working, what can you actually do?
First of all, there's very significant demand internally in this country. Charcoal is typically a poor man's fuel. So we need to make available alternative fuels like liquid petroleum, gas.
And what's the environmental impact of this?
If you look at aerial photographs in the south central part of the country, it's unrecognizable after 3 decades of charcoal trade. You can actually, from space, see the border between two countries, whereby on the Kenyan side, still very significant vegetation exists. And on the Somali side, pretty much you are looking at a plain desert.
Peter de Klerk. A new study says global tourism accounts for 8% of carbon emissions, 3 times higher than previous estimates. The research appears in the journal Nature Climate Change. Simon Calder, travel editor of the Independent newspaper here in London, explains.
Previously, they had simply looked at the carbon emissions to do with the passenger journey, as opposed to all the other elements. And if you take a wonderful destination such as Tahiti in the South Pacific, well, getting there is one thing. You've also then got to get everything to Tahiti for the tourist to enjoy.
And who are the worst offenders?
Places like the Netherlands, Denmark, Canada, Switzerland, where they're very green at home, but they seem to be very indulgent abroad. And the good people, as it were, are from China, from India, lower income places, where they will tend to use public transport.
Now, I have one friend who refuses to fly anywhere, but he's the only one.
Yeah.
Is it possible to be a green tourist if you fly halfway around the world?
Well, not really. But if you are going to fly long distance, then you really have to do it right. That means flying economy class, because that's more efficient. Going for modern aircraft. Go for a new Boeing 787 Dreamliner or an Airbus A350. And then when you get there, stay with a local family, eat at local cafes, buy locally made souvenirs. And of course, you are actually being a force for good. Tourism is a wonderful way of transferring wealth from richer countries to poorer nations, and hopefully having a great time.
That was the Independence intrepid Simon Calder. And in London, I'm Anu Anand with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.